Chapter 94. Robert Langdon was not a runner, but years of swimming made for powerful legs, and his stride was long. He reached the corner in a matter of seconds and rounded it, finding himself on a wider avenue. His eyes urgently scanned the sidewalks. She's got to be here. The rain had stopped, and from this corner, Langdon could clearly see the entire well-lit street. There was nowhere to hide. And yet Sienna seemed to have vanished. Langdon came to a stop, hands on his hips, panting as he surveyed the rain-soaked street before him. The only movement he saw was 50 yards ahead, where one of Istanbul's modern autobuses was pulling away from the curb and powering up the avenue. Did Sienna jump on a city bus? It seemed far too risky. Would she really trap herself on a bus, when she knew everyone would be looking for her? Then again, if she believed nobody had seen her round the corner, and if the bus had been just pulling away by chance, offering a perfectly timed opportunity, maybe. Affixed to the top of the bus was a destination sign, a programmable matrix of lights displaying a single word, Galata. Langdon rushed up the street toward an elderly man who was standing outside a restaurant under an awning. He was nicely dressed in an embroidered tunic and a white turban.
"Excuse me,"
Langdon said, breathless, arriving before him. "Do you speak English?" "Of course," the man said, looking unnerved by the urgency of Langdon's tone.
"Galata? That's a place?"
"Galata," the man replied. "Galata Bridge, Galata Tower, Galata Port." Langdon pointed to the departing autobus.
"Galata, where is the bus going?"
The man in the turban looked after the departing bus and considered it a moment.
"Galata Bridge," he replied. "It departs the old city and crosses the waterway."
Langdon groaned, his eyes making another frantic pass of the street but seeing no hint of Sienna. Sirens blared everywhere now, as emergency response vehicles tore past them in the direction of the cistern.
"What's happening?"
the man demanded, looking alarmed.
"Is everything okay?"
Langdon took another look at the departing bus and knew it was a gamble, but he had no other choice.
"No, sir," Langdon replied. "There's an emergency, and I need your help."
He motioned to the curb, where a valet had just delivered a slick silver Bentley.
"Is that your car?"
"It is, but
I need a ride," Langdon said. "I know we've never met, but something catastrophic is happening. It's a matter of life and death."
The turbaned man stared into the professor's eyes a long moment, as if searching his soul. Finally, he nodded.
"Then you'd better get in."
As the Bentley roared away from the curb, Langdon found himself gripping his seat. The man was clearly an experienced driver and seemed to enjoy the challenge of weaving in and out of traffic, playing catch-up with the bus. It took him less than 3 blocks to position his Bentley directly behind the autobus. Langdon leaned forward in his seat, squinting at the rear window. The interior lights were dim, and the only things Langdon could make out were the vague silhouettes of the passengers.
"Stay with the bus, please," Langdon said.
"And do you have a phone?" The man produced a cell phone from his pocket and handed it to his passenger, who thanked him profusely before realizing that he had no idea whom to call. He had no contact numbers for Sinsky or Bruder, and calling the WHO's offices in Switzerland could take forever.
"How do I reach the local police?" Langdon asked.
155, the man replied. "Anywhere in Istanbul."
Langdon dialed the 3 numbers and waited. The line seemed to ring forever. Finally, a recorded voice answered, conveying both in Turkish and English that due to high call volume, he would need to hold. Langdon wondered if the reason for the call volume was the crisis at the cistern. The sunken palace was now probably in a state of total pandemonium. He pictured Bruder wading out in the lagoon and wondered what he had discovered out there. Langdon had a sinking feeling he already knew. Sienna had gotten into the water before him. Up ahead, the bus's brake lights flashed, and the transport pulled over to a curbside bus stop. The Bentley's driver pulled over as well, idling about 50 feet behind the bus, providing Langdon a perfect view of the passengers getting on and off. Only 3 people disembarked, all of them men, and yet Langdon studied each carefully, fully aware of Sienna's skills for disguise. His eyes shifted again to the rear window. It was tinted, but the lights inside were now fully illuminated, and Langdon could see the people on board more clearly.
He leaned forward, craning his neck, holding his face close to the Bentley's windshield as he searched for Sienna.
Please don't tell me I gambled wrong.
Then he saw her, in the rearmost part of the vehicle, facing away from him, a pair of slender shoulders sloped up to the back of a shaved head.
It could only be Sienna.
As the bus accelerated, the interior lights faded once more. In the fleeting second before it disappeared into darkness, the head turned backward, glancing out the rear window. Langdon lowered himself down in the seat, into the shadows of the Bentley.
Did she see me?
His turbaned driver was already pulling out again, tailing the bus. The road was descending toward the water now, and up ahead Langdon could see the lights of a low-slung bridge that stretched out over the water. The bridge looked completely deadlocked with traffic. In fact, the entire area near its entrance looked congested.
Spice bazaar, the man said, very popular on rainy nights.
The man pointed down to the water's edge, where an incredibly long building sat in the shadow of one of Istanbul's more spectacular mosques. The new mosque, if Langdon were not mistaken, judging from the height of its famed twin minarets. The spice bazaar looked larger than most American malls, and Langdon could see people streaming in and out of its enormous arched doorway.
Hello? A tiny voice declared somewhere in the car. A childurum. Hello?
Langdon glanced down at the phone in his hand.
The police.
Yes, hello, Langdon blurted, raising the receiver. My name is Robert Langdon. I'm working with the World Health Organization. You have a major crisis at the city cistern, and I'm tailing the person responsible. She's on a bus near the Spice Bazaar, heading for...
One moment, please, the operator said. Let me connect you with dispatch.
No, wait!
But Langdon was on hold again. The Bentley's driver turned to him with a look of fear.
A crisis at the cistern?
Langdon was about to explain when the driver's face suddenly glowed red, like a demon.
Brake lights.
The driver's head whipped around and the Bentley skidded to a stop directly behind the bus. The interior lights flickered on again and Langdon could see Sienna as plain as day. She was standing at the back door, yanking repeatedly on the emergency stop cord and banging to get off the bus.
She saw me, Langdon realized.
No doubt Sienna had also seen the traffic on Galata Bridge and knew she could not afford to get caught in it. Langdon opened his door in a flash, but Sienna had already bolted from the bus and was sprinting into the night. Langdon tossed the cell phone back to its owner.
Tell the police what happened. Tell them to surround this area.
The turbaned man gave a frightened nod.
And thank you, Langdon shouted. Teşekkürler!
With that, Langdon dashed down the hill after Sienna, who was running directly toward the crowds milling around the spice bazaar. Chapter 95. Istanbul's 300-year-old spice bazaar is one of the largest covered marketplaces in the world. Built in the shape of an L, the sprawling complex has 88 vaulted rooms divided into hundreds of stalls, where local merchants zealously hawk a mind-boggling array of edible pleasures from around the world. Spices, fruits, herbs, and Istanbul's ubiquitous candy-like confection, Turkish Delight. The bazaar's entryway, a massive stone portal with a Gothic arch, is located on the corner of Çiçek Pazarı and Tahmis Street, and is said to witness the passage of more than 300,000 visitors a day. Tonight, as Langdon approached the swarming entrance, he felt as if all 300,000 were here at that very moment. He was still running hard, his eyes never leaving Sienna. She was now only 20 yards ahead of him, racing directly toward the bazaar's gateway and showing no signs of stopping. Sienna reached the arched portal and came up hard against the crowd. She snaked through the people, clawing her way inside. The moment she crossed the threshold, she stole a glance backward. Langdon saw in her eyes a frightened little girl, running scared, desperate, and out of control.
Sienna!
He shouted, but she plunged into the sea of humanity and was gone. Langdon dove in after her, bumping, pushing, craning his neck until he spotted her weaving down the bazaar's western hallway to his left. Burgeoning casks of exotic spices lined the way. Indian curry, Iranian saffron, Chinese flower tea. Their dazzling colors creating a tunnel of yellows, browns, and golds. With every step, Langdon smelled a new aroma. Pungent mushrooms, bitter roots, musky oils, all wafting through the air with a deafening chorus of languages from around the world.
The result was an overwhelming rush of sensory stimuli set against the unceasing thrum of people. Thousands of people. A wrenching feeling of claustrophobia gripped Langdon, and he almost pulled up before gathering himself again and forcing his way deeper into the bazaar. He could see Sienna just ahead, pushing through the masses with adamant force. She clearly was taking this ride to the end, wherever that might be for her. For a moment, Langdon wondered why he was chasing her. For justice? Considering what Sienna had done, Langdon could not begin to fathom what kind of punishment awaited her if she were caught. To prevent a pandemic? Whatever had been done was done. As Langdon pushed through the ocean of strangers, he suddenly realized why he wanted so badly to stop Sienna Brooks. I want answers. Only 10 yards ahead, Sienna was headed for an exit door at the end of the western arm of the bazaar. She stole another quick glance behind her, looking alarmed to see Langdon so close. As she turned again, facing front, she tripped and fell. Sienna's head snapped forward, colliding with the shoulder of the person in front of her. As he went down, her right hand shot out, searching for anything to break her fall. She found only the rim of a barrel of dried chestnuts, which she seized in desperation, pulling it over on top of her and sending a landslide of nuts across the floor. It took Langdon 3 strides to reach the spot where she had fallen. He looked down at the floor but saw only the toppled barrel and the chestnuts. No Sienna. The shopkeeper was screaming wildly.
Where did she go?
Langdon spun in a circle, but Sienna had somehow vanished. By the time his gaze landed on the western exit only 15 yards ahead, he knew that her dramatic fall had been anything but accidental. Langdon raced to the exit and burst out into an enormous plaza, also crowded with people. He stared into the plaza, searching in vain. Directly ahead, on the far side of a multi-lane highway, Galata Bridge stretched out across the wide waters of the Golden Horn. The dual minarets of the new mosque rose to Langdon's right, shining brightly over the plaza, and to his left was nothing but open plaza packed with people. The sound of blaring car horns drew Langdon's gaze ahead again, toward the highway that separated the plaza from the water. He saw Sienna, already 100 yards away, darting through speeding traffic and narrowly avoiding being crushed between 2 trucks. She was headed for the sea. To Langdon's left, on the banks of the Golden Horn, a transportation hub bustled with activity. Ferry docks, autobuses, taxis, tour boats. Langdon sprinted hard across the plaza toward the highway. When he reached the guardrail, he timed his leap with the oncoming headlights and safely bounded across the first of several 2-lane highways. For 15 seconds, assaulted by blinding headlights and angry car horns, Langdon managed to advance from median to median, stopping, starting, weaving, until he finally vaulted over the final guardrail onto the grassy banks of the sea. Although he could still see her, Sienna was a long way ahead, eschewing the taxi stand and idling buses, and heading directly for the docks, where Langdon saw all manner of boats moving in and out. Tourist barges, water taxis, private fishing boats, speedboats. Out across the water, city lights twinkled on the western side of the Golden Horn, and Langdon had no doubt that if Sienna reached the other side, there would be no hope of finding her, probably ever. When Langdon finally reached the waterfront, he turned left and dashed along the boardwalk, drawing startled looks from tourists who were queued up waiting to board a flotilla of gaudily decorated dinner barges, complete with mosque-like domes, faux gold flourishes, and blinking neon trim. Las Vegas on the Bosporus, Langdon moaned, powering past. He saw Sienna far ahead, and she was no longer running. She was stopped on the dock in an area cluttered by private powerboats, pleading with one of the owners.
Don't let her aboard.
As he closed the gap, he could see that Sienna's appeal was directed at a young man who stood at the helm of a sleek powerboat that was just preparing to pull away from the dock. The man was smiling, but politely shaking his head no. Sienna continued gesticulating, but the boater appeared to decline with finality, and he turned back to his controls. As Langdon dashed closer, Sienna glanced at him, her face a mask of desperation. Below her, the boat's twin outboards revved, churning the water and moving the craft away from the dock. Sienna was suddenly airborne, leaping off the dock over the open water. She landed with a crash on the boat's fiberglass stern. Feeling the impact, the driver turned with an expression of disbelief on his face. He yanked back the throttle, idling the boat, which was now 20 yards from the dock. Yelling angrily, he marched backward toward his unwanted passenger. As the driver advanced on her, Sienna effortlessly stepped aside, seizing the man's wrist and using his own momentum to launch him up and over the stern gunwale. The man plunged headlong into the water. Moments later, he rose to the surface, sputtering and thrashing wildly, and shouting a string of what were no doubt Turkish obscenities. Sienna seemed detached as she tossed a flotation cushion into the water, moved to the helm of the boat, and pushed the dual throttles forward. The engines roared, and the boat sped off. Langdon stood on the dock, catching his breath, as he watched the sleek white hull skimming away across the water, becoming a ghostly shadow in the night. Langdon raised his eyes toward the horizon, and knew that Sienna now had access not only to the distant shores, but also to an almost endless web of waterways that stretched from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. She's gone. Nearby, the boat's owner climbed out of the water, got to his feet, and hurried off to call the police. Langdon felt starkly alone as he watched the lights of the stolen boat growing faint. The whine of the powerful engines was growing distant as well. And then the engines faded abruptly to silence. Langdon peered into the distance. Did she kill the motor? The boat's lights seemed to have stopped receding, and were now bobbing gently in the small waves of the Golden Horn. For some unknown reason, Sienna Brooks had stopped. Did she run out of gas? He cupped his hands and listened, now able to hear the faint thrum of her engines idling. If she's not out of gas, what is she doing? Langdon waited. 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds. Then, without warning, the engines revved up again, reluctantly at first, and then more decidedly. To Langdon's bewilderment, the boat's lights began banking into a wide turn, and the bow swung around toward him. She's coming back. As the boat approached, Langdon could see Sienna at the wheel, staring blankly ahead. 30 yards away, she throttled down and eased the boat safely back to the dock it had just left. Then she killed the engines. Silence. Above her, Langdon stared down in disbelief. Sienna never looked up. Instead, she buried her face in her hands. She began trembling, her shoulders hunched and shuddering. When she finally looked at Langdon, her eyes were overflowing with tears.
"Robert," she sobbed, "I can't run away anymore. I have nowhere left to go."
Chapter 96.
It's out.
Elizabeth Sinsky stood at the bottom of the cistern stairwell and gazed at the void of the evacuated cavern. Her breathing felt strained through the respirator she was wearing, although she had probably already been exposed to whatever pathogen might be down here. Sinsky felt relieved to be wearing a hazmat suit as she and the SRS team entered the desolate space. They were dressed in bulbous white jumpsuits that locked into airtight helmets, and the group looked like a team of astronauts breaching an alien spacecraft. Sinsky knew that upstairs on the street, hundreds of frightened concertgoers and musicians were huddling in confusion, many being treated for injuries suffered in the stampede. Others had fled the area entirely. She felt lucky to have escaped with only a bruised knee and a broken amulet.
"Only one form of contagion travels faster than a virus," Sinsky thought, "and that's fear."
The doors upstairs were now locked, hermetically sealed, and guarded by local authorities. Sinsky had anticipated a jurisdictional showdown with the arriving local police, but any potential conflicts had evaporated instantly when they saw the SRS team's biohazard gear and heard Sinsky's warnings of a possible plague.
"We're on our own,"
the director of the WHO thought, staring out at the forest of columns reflected in the lagoon.
"Nobody wants to come down here."
Behind her, two agents were stretching a huge polyurethane sheet across the bottom of the stairwell and sealing it to the wall with a heat gun. Two others had found an open area of boardwalk planks and had begun setting up an array of electronic gear as if preparing to analyze a crime scene.
That's exactly what this is, Sinsky thought. A crime scene.
She again pictured the woman in the wet burqa who had fled the cistern. By all appearances, Sienna Brooks had risked her own life in order to sabotage the WHO's containment efforts and fulfill Zobrist's twisted mission.
She came down here and broke the Soljublan bag.
Langdon had chased Sienna off into the night, and Sinsky had still not received word regarding what had happened to either of them.
I hope Professor Langdon is safe, she thought.
Agent Bruder stood dripping on the boardwalk, staring blankly out at the inverted head of Medusa, and wondering how to proceed. As an SRS agent, Bruder had been trained to think on the macrocosmic level, setting aside any immediate ethical or personal concerns, and focusing on saving as many lives as possible over the long term. Threats to his own health had barely registered on him until this moment.
I've waded into this stuff, he thought,
chastising himself for the risky action he had taken, and yet knowing he'd had little choice.
We needed an immediate assessment.
Bruder forced his thoughts to the task at hand. Implement Plan B. Unfortunately, in a containment crisis, Plan B was always the same.
Widen the radius.
Fighting communicable disease was often like fighting a forest fire. Sometimes you had to drop back and surrender a battle in hopes of winning the war. At this point, Bruder had still not given up the idea that a full containment was possible. Most likely, Sienna Brooks had ruptured the bag only minutes before the mass hysteria and evacuation. If that were true, even though hundreds of people had fled the scene, everyone might have been located far enough away from the source to avoid contamination.
Everyone except Langdon and Sienna, Bruder realized, both of whom were here at Ground Zero, and are now someplace out in the city.
Bruder had another concern as well, a gap in logic that continued to nag at him. While in the water, he had never found the actual breached Soljublan bag. It seemed to Bruder that if Sienna had broken the bag, by kicking it or ripping it or whatever she had done, he would have found the damaged, deflated remnants floating somewhere in the area. But Bruder had found nothing. Any remains of the bag seemed to have vanished. Bruder strongly doubted that Sienna would have carried off the Soljublan bag with her, since by this point it would have been no more than a slimy, dissolving mess.
So where did it go?
Bruder had an uneasy sense that he was missing something. Even so, he focused on a new containment strategy, which required him to answer one critical question.
What is the contagion's current dispersal radius?
Bruder knew the question would be answered in a matter of minutes. His team had set up a series of portable virus detection devices along the boardwalks at increasing distances from the lagoon. These devices, known as PCR units, used what was called a polymerase chain reaction to detect the presence of viral contamination. The SRS agent remained hopeful. With no movement of the water in the lagoon and the passage of very little time, he was confident that the PCR devices would detect a relatively small region of contamination, which they could then attack with chemicals and the use of suction.
Ready?
A technician called out through a megaphone. Agents stationed around the cistern gave the thumbs up.
Run your samples,
the megaphone crackled. Throughout the cavern, analysts crouched down and started their individual PCR machines. Each device began analyzing a sample from the point at which its operator was located on the boardwalk, spaced in ever-widening arcs around Zobrist's plaque. A hush fell across the cistern as everyone waited, praying to see only green lights. And then it happened. On the machine closest to Bruder, a virus detection light began flashing red. His muscles tensed, and his eyes shifted to the next machine. It too began blinking red.
No.
Stunned murmurs reverberated throughout the cavern. Bruder watched in horror as, one by one, every PCR device began blinking red all the way across the cistern to the entrance.
Oh, God,
he thought. The sea of blinking red detection lights, painted an unmistakable picture. The radius of contamination was enormous. The entire cistern was teeming with virus. Chapter 97. Robert Langdon stared down at Sienna Brooks, huddled at the wheel of the stolen powerboat, and struggled to make sense of what he had just witnessed.
"I'm sure you despise me," she sobbed, looking up at him through tearful eyes.
"Despise you?" Langdon exclaimed. "I don't have the slightest idea who you are. All you've done is lie to me."
"I know," she said softly. "I'm sorry. I've been trying to do the right thing."
"By releasing a plague?"
"No, Robert, you don't understand."
"I do understand," Langdon replied. "I understand you waded out into the water to break that Solublon bag. You wanted to release Zobrist's virus before anyone could contain it."
"Solublon bag?"
Sienna's eyes flashed confusion.
"I don't know what you're talking about. Robert, I went to the cistern to stop Bertrand's virus, to steal it and make it disappear forever, so nobody could ever study it, including Dr. Sinsky and the WHO.
"Steal it? Why keep it from the WHO? Sienna took a long breath.
"There's so much you don't know, but it's all moot now. We arrived much too late, Robert. We never had a chance."
"Of course we had a chance. The virus was not going to be released until tomorrow. That's the date Zobrist chose. And if you hadn't gone into the water—"
"Robert, I didn't release the virus," Sienna yelled. "When I went into the water, I was trying to find it. But it was too late. There was nothing there."
"I don't believe you," Langdon said.
"I know you don't, and I don't blame you."
She reached into her pocket and pulled out a soggy pamphlet.
"But maybe this will help."
She tossed the paper to Langdon.
"I found this just before I waded into the lagoon."
He caught it and opened it up. It was a concert program for the cistern's 7 performances of the Dante Symphony.
"Look at the dates," she said.
Langdon read the dates and then reread them, puzzled by what he saw. For some reason, he had been under the impression that this evening's performance was opening night, the first of 7 performances to be given during the week, designed to lure people into a plague-infested cistern. This program, however, told a different story. "Tonight was closing night?" Langdon asked, glancing up from the paper. "The orchestra has been playing all week?" Sienna nodded.
"I was as surprised as you are."
She paused, her eyes somber.
"The virus is already out, Robert. It has been for a week."
"That can't be true," Langdon argued. "Tomorrow is the date. Zobrist even made a plaque with tomorrow's date on it."
"Yes, I saw the plaque in the water."
"Then you know he was fixated on tomorrow." Sienna sighed.
"Robert, I knew Bertrand well. Better than I ever admitted to you. He was a scientist. A results-oriented person. I now realize that the date on the plaque is not the virus's release date. It's something else. Something more important to his goal."
"And that would be?" Sienna gazed up solemnly from the boat.
"It's a global saturation date. A mathematical projection of the date after which his virus will have propagated across the world and infected every individual."
The prospect sent a visceral tremor through Langdon, and yet he couldn't help but suspect that she was lying. Her story contained a fatal flaw, and Sienna Brooks had already proven she'd lie about anything. "One problem, Sienna," he said, staring down at her. "If this plague is already spread all over the world, then why aren't people getting sick?" Sienna glanced away, suddenly unable to meet his gaze. "If this plague has been out a week," Langdon repeated, "why aren't people dying?" She turned slowly back to him.
"Because,"
she began, the words catching in her throat,
"Bertrand didn't create a plague."
Her eyes welled up again with tears.
"He created something far more dangerous."
Chapter 98. Despite the flow of oxygen that passed through her respirator, Elizabeth Sinsky felt lightheaded. 5 minutes had passed since Bruder's PCR devices had revealed the horrifying truth.
Our window for containment closed long ago.
The Solublon bag had apparently dissolved sometime last week, most likely on the opening night of the concert, which Sinsky now knew had been playing for several nights straight. The few remaining shreds of Solublon attached to the tether had not disappeared, only because they had been coated with an adhesive to help secure them to the tether's clasp.
The contagion has been out for a week.
Now, with no possibility of isolating the pathogen, the SRS agents huddled over samples in the cistern's makeshift lab and assumed their usual fallback position: analysis, classification, and threat assessment. So far, the PCR units had revealed only one solid piece of data, and the discovery surprised no one.
The virus was now airborne.
The contents of the Solublon bag had apparently bubbled up to the surface and aerosolized viral particles into the air.
It wouldn't take many, Sinsky knew, especially in such an enclosed area.
A virus, unlike a bacteria or chemical pathogen, could spread through a population with astounding speed and penetration. Parasitic in their behavior, viruses entered an organism and attached to a host cell in a process called adsorption. They then injected their own DNA or RNA into that cell, recruiting the invaded cell and forcing it to replicate multiple versions of the virus. Once a sufficient number of copies existed, the new virus particles would kill the cell and burst through the cell wall, speeding off to find new host cells to attack. And the process would be repeated. An infected individual would then exhale or sneeze, sending respiratory droplets out of his body. These droplets would remain suspended in the air until they were inhaled by other hosts, and the process began all over again.
Exponential growth,
Sinsky mused, recalling Zobrist's graphs illustrating the human population explosion.
Zobrist is using the exponential growth of viruses to combat the exponential growth of people.
The burning question now, however, was, how would this virus behave? Coldly stated,
how will it attack its host?
The Ebola virus impaired the blood's ability to coagulate, resulting in unstoppable hemorrhaging. The hantavirus triggered the lungs to fail. A whole host of viruses known as oncoviruses caused cancer. And the HIV virus attacked the immune system, causing the disease AIDS. It was no secret in the medical community that, had the HIV virus gone airborne, it could have been an extinction event.
So what the hell does Zobrist's virus do?
Whatever it did, the effects clearly took time to reveal themselves, and nearby hospitals had reported no cases of patients showing symptoms that were out of the ordinary. Impatient for answers, Sinsky moved toward the lab. She saw Bruder standing near the stairwell, having found a faint signal for his cell phone. He was speaking to someone in hushed tones. She hurried over, arriving just as he was finishing his call.
Okay. Understood, Bruder said,
the look on his face expressing an emotion between disbelief and terror.
And once again, I cannot stress strongly enough the confidentiality of this information. Your eyes only at this point. Call me when you know more. Thanks.
He hung up.
What's going on? Sinsky demanded.
Bruder blew out a slow breath.
I just spoke to an old friend of mine who is a top virologist at the CDC in Atlanta.
Sinsky bristled.
You alerted the CDC without my authorization?
I made a judgment call, he replied. My contact will be discreet, and we're going to need far better data than we can get from this makeshift lab.
Sinsky glanced over at the handful of SRS agents who were taking water samples and huddling over portable electronics.
He's right.
My CDC contact, Bruder continued, is standing in a fully equipped microbiology lab and has already confirmed the existence of an extremely contagious and never-before-seen viral pathogen.
Hold on, Sinsky interjected. How did you get him a sample so fast?
I didn't, Bruder said tautly. He tested
his own blood. Sinsky needed only a moment for the meaning to register.
It's already gone global.
Chapter 99. Langdon walked slowly, feeling strangely disembodied, as if he were moving through a particularly vivid nightmare. What could be more dangerous than a plague? Sienna had said nothing more since she had climbed out of the boat and motioned for Langdon to follow her away from the docks, along a quiet gravel path, farther away from the water and the crowds. Although Sienna's tears had stopped, Langdon sensed a torrent of emotion building up within her. He could hear sirens wailing in the distance, but Sienna appeared not to notice. She was staring blankly at the ground, seemingly hypnotized by the rhythmic crunch of the gravel beneath their feet. They entered a small park, and Sienna guided him into a dense grove of trees where they were hidden away from the world. Here they sat on a bench that overlooked the water. On the far shore, the ancient Galata Tower glistened above the quiet residences that dotted the hillside. The world looked strangely peaceful from here. A far cry, Langdon imagined, from what was probably transpiring at the cistern. By now, he suspected, Sinsky and the SRS team had realized that they had arrived too late to stop the plague. Beside him, Sienna stared out across the sea.
"I don't have much time, Robert," she said. "The authorities will eventually figure out where I went. But before they do, I need you to hear the truth. All of it."
Langdon gave her a silent nod. Sienna wiped her eyes and shifted on the bench to face him fully.
"Bertrand Zobrist," she began. "He was my first love. He became my mentor."
"I've already been told, Sienna," Langdon said. She gave him a startled look but continued speaking, as if afraid to lose her momentum.
"I met him at an impressionable age, and his ideas and intellect bewitched me. Bertrand believed, as I do, that our species is on the brink of collapse, that we're facing a horrifying end, which is racing toward us so much faster than anyone dares accept."
Langdon made no reply.
"My entire childhood," Sienna said, "I wanted to save the world. And all I was ever told was, you can't save the world, so don't sacrifice your happiness trying."
She paused, her face taut, holding back tears.
"Then I met Bertrand, a beautiful, brilliant man, who told me not only that saving the world was possible, but that doing so was a moral imperative. He introduced me to an entire circle of like-minded individuals, people of staggering abilities and intellect, people who really could change the future. For the first time in my life, I no longer felt all alone, Robert."
Langdon offered a soft smile, sensing the pain in her words.
"I've endured some terrible things in my life," Sienna continued, her voice increasingly unsteady. "Things I've had trouble moving past."
She broke his gaze and ran an anxious palm across her bald scalp before collecting herself and turning back to him.
"And maybe that's why the only thing that keeps me going is my belief that we are capable of being better than we are. Capable of taking action to avoid a catastrophic future."
"And Bertrand believed that too?" Langdon asked.
"Absolutely. Bertrand had boundless hope for humankind. He was a transhumanist who believed we are living on the threshold of a glittering post-human age, an era of true transformation. He had the mind of a futurist, eyes that could see down the road in ways few others could even imagine. He understood the astonishing powers of technology and believed that in the span of several generations, our species would become a different animal entirely, genetically enhanced to be healthier, smarter, stronger, even more compassionate."
She paused.
"Except for one problem. He didn't think we'd live long enough as a species to realize that possibility."
"Due to overpopulation," Langdon said.
She nodded. "The Malthusian catastrophe. Bertrand used to tell me he felt like St. George trying to slay the Thonic monster."
Langdon didn't follow her meaning. "Medusa?"
"Metaphorically, yes. Medusa and the entire class of Thonic deities live underground because they're associated directly with Mother Earth.
In allegory, thonics are always symbols of fertility, Langdon said, startled that the parallel had not occurred to him earlier. Fruitfulness, population.
Yes, fertility,
Sienna replied.
Bertrand used the term thonic monster to represent the ominous threat of our own fecundity. He described our overpopulation of offspring as a monster looming on the horizon, a monster we needed to contain immediately before it consumed us all.
Our own virility stalks us, Langdon realized. The thonic monster.
And Bertrand battled this monster...
how?
Please understand, she said defensively. These are not easy problems to solve. Triage is always a messy process. A man who severs the leg of a 3-year-old child is a horrific criminal, until that man is a doctor who saves the child from gangrene. Sometimes the only choice is the lesser of two evils.
She began tearing up again.
I believe Bertrand had a noble goal, but his methods...
She looked away on the verge of breaking down. Sienna, Langdon whispered gently, I need to understand all of this. I need you to explain to me what Bertrand did. What did he release into the world? Sienna faced him again, her soft brown eyes radiating a darker fear.
He released a virus, she whispered. A very specific kind of virus.
Langdon held his breath. Tell me.
Bertrand created something known as a viral vector. It's a virus intentionally designed to install genetic information into the cell it's attacking.
Sienna paused to let him process the idea.
A vector virus, rather than killing its host cell, inserts a piece of predetermined DNA into that cell, essentially modifying the cell's genome.
Langdon struggled to grasp her meaning. This virus changes our DNA?
The insidious nature of this virus, Sienna continued, is that none of us know it has infected us. No one gets sick. It causes no overt symptoms to suggest that it's changing us genetically.
For a moment, Langdon could feel the blood pulsing in his veins. And what changes does it make?
Sienna closed her eyes for a moment. Robert, she whispered, as soon as this virus was released into the cistern's lagoon, a chain reaction began. Every person who descended into that cavern and breathed the air became infected. They became viral hosts, unwitting accomplices who transferred the virus to others, sparking an exponential proliferation of disease that will now have torn across the planet like a forest fire. By now, the virus will have penetrated the global population. You, me, everyone.
Langdon rose from the bench and began pacing frantically before her.
And what does it do to us? He repeated.
Sienna was silent for a long moment.
The virus has the ability to render the human body infertile.
She shifted uncomfortably.
Bertrand created a sterility plague.
Her words struck Langdon hard. A virus that makes us infertile? Langdon knew there existed viruses that could cause sterility, but a highly contagious airborne pathogen that could do so by altering us genetically seemed to belong in another world, some kind of Orwellian dystopia of the future.
Bertrand often theorized about a virus like this, Sienna said quietly, but I never imagined he would attempt to create it, much less succeed. When I got his letter and learned what he had done, I was in shock. I tried desperately to find him, to beg him to destroy his creation. But I arrived too late.
Hold on, Langdon interjected, finally finding his voice. If the virus makes everyone on Earth infertile, there will be no new generations, and the human race will start dying out immediately.
Correct, she responded, her voice sounding small. Except extinction was not Bertrand's goal. Quite the opposite, in fact. Which is why he created a randomly activating virus. Even though Inferno is now endemic in all human DNA, and will be passed along by all of us from this generation forward, it will activate only in a certain percentage of people. In other words, the virus is now carried by everyone on Earth, and yet it will cause sterility in only a randomly selected part of the population.
What part?
Langdon heard himself say, incredulous even to be asking such a question.
Well, as you know, Bertrand was fixated on the Black Death, the plague that indiscriminately killed one-third of the European population. Nature, he believed, knew how to cull itself. When Bertrand did the math on infertility, he was exhilarated to discover that the plague's death rate of 1 in 3 seemed to be the precise ratio required to start winnowing the human population at a manageable rate.
That's monstrous, Langdon thought.
The Black Plague thinned the herd and paved the way for the Renaissance, she said. And Bertrand created Inferno as a kind of modern-day catalyst for global renewal. A transhumanist Black Death. The difference being that those manifesting the disease, rather than perishing, would simply become infertile. Assuming Bertrand's virus has taken hold, one-third of the world's population is now sterile, and one-third of the population will continue to be sterile for all time. The effect would be similar to that of a recessive gene, which gets passed along to all offspring, and yet exerts its influence in only a small percentage of them.
Sienna's hands were shaking as she continued.
In Bertrand's letter to me, he sounded quite proud, saying he considered Inferno to be a very elegant and humane resolution of the problem.
Fresh tears formed in her eyes, and she wiped them away.
Compared to the virulence of the Black Death, I admit there is some compassion in this approach. There will be no hospitals overflowing with the sick and dying, no bodies rotting in the streets, and no anguished survivors enduring the death of loved ones. Humans will simply stop having so many babies. Our planet will experience a steady reduction in our birth rate until the population curve actually inverts, and our total numbers begin to decrease.
She paused.
The result will be far more potent than the plague, which only briefly curbed our numbers, creating a temporary dip in the graph of human expansion. With Inferno, Bertrand created a long-term solution, a permanent solution, a transhumanist solution. He was a germline genetic engineer. He solved problems at the root level.
It's genetic terrorism, Langdon whispered. It's changing who we are, who we've always been, at the most fundamental level.
Bertrand didn't see it that way. He dreamed of fixing the fatal flaw in human evolution, the fact that our species is simply too prolific. We are an organism that, despite our unmatched intellect, cannot seem to control our own numbers. No amount of free contraception, education, or government enticement works. We keep having babies, whether we want to or not. Did you know the CDC just announced that nearly half of all pregnancies in the U.S. are unplanned? And in underdeveloped nations, that number is over 70%.
Langdon had seen these statistics before, and yet only now was he starting to understand their implications. As a species, humans were like the rabbits that were introduced on certain Pacific islands and allowed to reproduce unchecked to the point that they decimated their ecosystem and finally went extinct. Bertrand Zobrist has redesigned our species in an attempt to save us, transforming us into a less fruitful population. Langdon took a deep breath and stared out at the Bosporus, feeling as ungrounded as the boats sailing in the distance. The sirens were growing still louder, coming from the direction of the docks, and Langdon sensed that time was running out.
The most frightening thing of all, Sienna said, is not that Inferno causes sterility, but rather that it has the ability to do so. An airborne viral vector is a quantum leap, years ahead of its time. Bertrand has suddenly lifted us out of the dark ages of genetic engineering and launched us headlong into the future. He has unlocked the evolutionary process and given humankind the ability to redefine our species in broad, sweeping strokes. Pandora is out of the box, and there's no putting her back in. Bertrand has created the keys to modify the human race, and if those keys fall into the wrong hands, then God help us. This technology should never have been created.
As soon as I read Bertrand's letter explaining how he had achieved his goals, I burned it. Then I vowed to find his virus and destroy all traces of it.
I don't understand, Langdon declared, his voice laced with anger. If you wanted to destroy the virus, why didn't you cooperate with Dr. Sinsky and the WHO? You should have called the CDC or someone.
You can't be serious. Government agencies are the last entities on Earth that should have access to this technology. Think about it, Robert. Throughout all of human history, every groundbreaking technology ever discovered by science has been weaponized, from simple fire to nuclear power, and almost always at the hands of powerful governments. Where do you think our biological weapons come from? They originate from research done at places like the WHO and CDC. Bertrand's technology, a pandemic virus used as a genetic vector, is the most powerful weapon ever created. It paves the way for horrors we can't yet even imagine, including targeted biological weapons. Imagine a pathogen that attacks only those people whose genetic code contains certain ethnic markers. It could enable widespread ethnic cleansing on the genetic level.
I see your concerns, Sienna. I do. But this technology could also be used for good, couldn't it? Isn't this discovery a godsend for genetic medicine? A new way to deliver global inoculations, for example?
Perhaps. But unfortunately, I've learned to expect the worst from people who hold power.
In the distance, Langdon could hear the whine of a helicopter shatter the air. He peered through the trees back in the direction of the spice bazaar and saw the running lights of an aircraft skimming up over the hill and streaking toward the docks. Sienna tensed.
I need to go,
she said, standing up and glancing to the west toward Ataturk Bridge.
I think I can get across the bridge on foot, and from there reach...
You're not leaving, Sienna, he said firmly.
Robert, I came back because I felt I owed you an explanation. Now you have it.
No, Sienna, Langdon said. You came back because you've been running your whole life, and you finally realized you can't run anymore. Sienna seemed to shrink before him.
What choice do I have?
She asked, watching the helicopter scan the water.
They'll put me in prison as soon as they find me.
You've done nothing wrong, Sienna. You didn't create this virus, nor did you release it.
True, but I went to great lengths to prevent the World Health Organization from finding it. If I don't end up in a Turkish prison, I'll face some kind of international tribunal on charges of biological terrorism.
As the thrum of the helicopter grew louder, Langdon looked toward the docks in the distance. The craft was hovering in place, rotors churning the water as its searchlight strafed the boats. Sienna looked ready to bolt at any instant.
Please listen, Langdon said, softening his tone. I know you've been through a lot, and I know you're scared, but you need to think of the big picture. Bertrand created this virus. You tried to stop it.
But I failed.
Yes, and now that the virus is out, the scientific and medical communities will need to understand it fully. You're the only person who knows anything at all about it. Maybe there's a way to neutralize it or do something to prepare. Langdon's penetrating gaze bore into her. Sienna, the world needs to know what you know. You can't just disappear. Sienna's slim frame was shaking now, as if the floodgates of sorrow and uncertainty were about to burst wide.
Robert, I don't know what to do. I don't even know who I am anymore. Look at me.
She put a hand on her bald scalp.
I've turned into a monster. How can I possibly face...
Langdon stepped forward and wrapped his arms around her. He could feel her body trembling, feel her frailty against his chest. He whispered softly in her ear.
Sienna, I know you want to run, but I'm not going to let you. Sooner or later, you need to start trusting someone. I can't, she was sobbing. I'm not sure I know how.
Langdon held her tighter. You start small. You take that first tiny step. You trust me. Chapter 100. The sharp clang of metal on metal rang through the fuselage of the windowless C-130 transport, causing the provost to jump. Outside, someone was banging the butt of a pistol against the aircraft's hatch and demanding entry.
Everyone stay seated, the C-130 pilot commanded, moving toward the door. It's the Turkish police. They just drove out to the plane. The provost and Ferris exchanged a quick glance. From the flurry of panicked calls among the WHO's staff on board, the provost sensed that their containment mission had failed. Zelbrist carried out his plan, he thought, and my company made it possible. Outside the hatch, authoritative-sounding voices began shouting in Turkish. The provost jumped to his feet.
"Don't open the door,"
he ordered the pilot. The pilot stopped short, glaring at the provost.
"Why the hell not?"
"The WHO is an international relief organization," the provost replied, "and this plane is sovereign territory." The pilot shook his head. "Sir, this plane is parked at a Turkish airport, and until it leaves Turkish airspace, it is subject to the laws of the land." The pilot moved to the exit and threw open the hatch. Two uniformed men stared in. Their humorless eyes showed not the slightest hint of leniency.
"Who is the captain of this aircraft?"
one of them demanded in a heavy accent.
"I am," the pilot said.
An officer handed the pilot two sheets of paper.
"Arrest documents. These two passengers must come with us."
The pilot skimmed the pages and glanced over at the provost and Ferris.
"Call Dr. Sinsky," the provost ordered the WHO pilot. "We're on an international emergency mission."
One of the officers eyed the provost with an amused sneer.
"Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky, director of the World Health Organization? She is the one who ordered your arrest."
"That can't be," the provost replied. "Mr. Ferris and I are here in Turkey trying to help Dr. Sinsky."
"Then you're not doing a very good job,"
the second officer replied.
"Dr. Sinsky contacted us and named you both as conspirators in a bioterrorism plot on Turkish soil."
He pulled out handcuffs. "You are both coming to headquarters for questioning."
"I demand an attorney," the provost shouted.
30 seconds later, he and Ferris were shackled, muscled down the gangway and shoved roughly into the back seat of a black sedan. The sedan raced away, skimming across the tarmac to a remote corner of the airport, where it stopped at a chicken wire fence that had been cut and pulled apart to allow their car to pass. Once through the perimeter fence, the car bounced across a dusty wasteland of broken airport machinery and came to a halt near an old service building. The two uniformed men got out of the sedan and scanned the area. Apparently satisfied that they had not been followed, they stripped off their police uniforms and tossed them aside. Then they helped Ferris and the provost out of the car and removed their handcuffs. The provost rubbed his wrists, realizing that he would not do well in captivity.
"The car keys are under the mat," one of the agents said, motioning to a white van parked nearby. "There's a duffel in the back seat with everything you requested. Travel documents, cash, prepaid phones, clothing, as well as a few other items we thought you might appreciate."
"Thank you," the provost said. "You guys are good."
"Just well trained, sir."
With that, the two Turkish men got back into the black sedan and drove off. Sinsky was never going to let me walk away, the provost reminded himself. Having sensed as much while flying to Istanbul, the provost had emailed an alert to the consortium's local branch, indicating that he and Ferris might need an extraction.
"You think she'll come after us?" Ferris asked.
"Sinsky?" The provost nodded. "Absolutely, although I suspect she has other concerns at the moment." The two men climbed into the white van and the provost rummaged through the contents of the duffel, getting their documentation in order. He pulled out a baseball cap and slipped it on. Wrapped inside the cap, he found a small bottle of Highland Park single malt. "These guys are good." The provost eyed the amber liquid, telling himself he should wait until tomorrow. Then again, he pictured Zobrist's Solublon bag and wondered what tomorrow would even look like. "I broke my cardinal rule," he thought. "I gave up my client." The provost felt strangely adrift, knowing that in the coming days the world would be blanketed with news of a catastrophe in which he had played a very significant role. "This would not have happened without me." For the first time in his life, ignorance no longer felt like the moral high ground. His fingers broke the seal on the bottle of scotch. "Enjoy it," he told himself. "One way or another, your days are numbered."
The provost took a deep pull on the bottle, relishing the warmth in his throat. Suddenly, the darkness lit up with spotlights and the blue flashing strobes of police cars, which surrounded them on all sides. The provost looked frantically in every direction, and then sat as still as stone. No escape. As armed Turkish police officers approached the van, rifles extended, the provost took a final sip of Highland Park and quietly raised his hands over his head. This time, he knew the officers were not his own.